Thank you, Jerry and Ryan, for leading us in worship. It is so good to be here among you and to continue to celebrate Easter together as we praise the name of our risen Savior. The sermon I'm going to preach this morning is based upon a sermon that was written by my brother-in-law, Mike Abma, who is the pastor at Woodlawn Christian Reformed in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And I'm very grateful once again for his leadership. This Abraham story is a resurrection story, an Easter story. In fact, it is in many ways the main Easter story of the Old Testament. Now, why do I say that? Well, to answer that, we need to think a little bit about the book of Genesis. How does Genesis start? It starts with God calling creation into existence out of nothing. It starts with God creating order out of chaos. But as Genesis goes on, things gradually slip back into chaos. By chapter 11, the Tower of Babel story becomes emblematic of the way of the future for all of creation. It is all drifting from God and coming to nothing, one big dead-end project. So in our text, God stands there at the tomb of Genesis 11, so to speak, and calls out to Abraham to be the beginning of something new, something radically new. The story of the Bible and of the history of the world changes with that first word that God utters to Abraham in chapter 12, leave. In Hebrew, it has a poetic lilt to it, let leda. Leave your country, your kindred, your father's house. In other words, leave everything you know, everything that gives your life safety and security and comfort, and go where I tell you to go. It is a command that sounds so much like what Jesus says centuries later, come, follow me. Leave your father and mother, your brothers and sisters, don't even bother looking back. So how old was Abraham when he heard this command? He was 75 years old. And how old is 75? Well, I thought about having all the 75-year-olds stand up just for a minute to give the younger folks a look at what 75 looks like, but I thought, well, that might get me into trouble. So let me just simply say that at 75, we are no longer spring chickens. At 75, we are advised to make low-risk investments and to do low-impact aerobics. At 75, the fewer jolts and surprises, the better. Now, those of you who are 75 or older, you might be sitting there thinking, now, wait a minute, I got lots of spunk left, and I believe you. Michelangelo began designing St. Peter's in Rome at the age of 71. Marc Chagall began his famous 12 stained glass windows in the Hadassah Hospital in Jerusalem at the age of 74. Thomas Edison was still taking out patents on new inventions at the age of 81. And perhaps you remember Robin Gard, the man who received his MA in history from Brock University last year at the age of 93. So I'm not saying that at 75 life is over. What I am saying is that for most of us, by age 75, we like predictability in life. When we wake up in the morning, we like to find our slippers under the bed, orange juice in the fridge, coffee in the pot, and bran flakes in the bowl. for breakfast, just like we have every morning. At 75, if given the choice between predictable and precarious, most of us will choose predictable every time. But it was a new day, a new morning, when God came to Abraham, telling him to leave everything behind and go where he was told. The command came with a promise. God said, I will make you a great nation. I will make your name great. You will be a blessing to all the nations of the world. It was a big promise. As far as promises go, they don't get much bigger. A promise almost as big as Jesus saying, I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me will live even though they die. What is so surprising is who God chooses to give this command and promise to. From all the people on the planet, he picks two people that seem to have the least going for them. He calls Abraham, a man getting along in years, or as Paul says less delicately in our passage from Romans, someone already as good as dead. And Sarah, Abraham's wife, what about her? She was barren. No children, with little to no hope that she would ever have any. Of all the people on the planet, God chooses these two. But isn't that so much like God? The God of the resurrection, loving to give life where there was no life before, and hope where there was no hope before. There are probably many things that stand in our way of hearing God's promises and believing them. But the two biggest ones are probably pride and despair. First, pride. Pride says, who needs God to make us great? I can do that myself. May is the month for convocation speeches at the university, graduation talks. They're coming up soon. I spent a few minutes this past week surfing through the various convocation addresses. They're available on the web. Many of them are variations on the same be all that you can be kind of theme. Create the highest vision for your life because you are what you believe. That's an actual quote. The true measure of a career is to be able to be content, even proud, that you succeeded through your own endeavors. No dream is too big. No goal is too grand. Make a name for yourself in this world. The sky's the limit. After a while, these commencement addresses start to sound like the cheering section for the builders of the Tower of Babel. Pride. It is the belief that we make our own future. The other extreme is despair. When our careers crash, our marriages break down, our bodies fail, when we realize everything falls apart, everything is a dead end, everything is a Tower of Babel. Then it is easy to despair, to assume that nothing can change or improve the future. This morning, the voice of God calls to us. Whether we are trapped in the illusions of pride or in the prison of despair, the voice of God comes in the risen Christ and promises us something new, something outside of ourselves, something bigger and better than we can imagine. Through the risen Christ, we are given the promise that we are God's own children and that we will live to enjoy Him forever. What sets Abraham apart is that he not only hears God's promise, but that he believes and obeys. He leaves the comfort, the safety, the security of his home, and he journeys by stages to the Negev. The Negev. Do you know what the Negev is? It's basically a desert region in southern Judah. It is, according to Isaiah 30, a land of trouble and distress. It is the land of difficulty and danger, the land of sacrifice and insecurity. It is this faith that Paul marvels over in Romans 4. This faith, this radical trust, it's not a mind thing. If it was simply a mind thing, Abraham could have stayed comfortably at home in Haran. No. His faith was a life thing. It was a life of daily obedience and a lifestyle of sacrifice. That is something about the resurrection that we often overlook. We tend to forget the resurrection of Jesus is actually God's stamp of approval on this kind of daily life of obedience and sacrifice. We tend to forget that the resurrection of Jesus is God's stamp of approval on the way of the cross, and an obedience that might even lead to death. John Sook, the former editor of the Banner, once wrote about a conversation he had in seminary with a friend of his from Nigeria. The two of them often talked about the differences between African Christians and North American Christians. What this Nigerian friend was most troubled about was a lack of obedience and faithful suffering in North American Christians. One day, this friend showed John a picture from the Good News for Modern Man Bible. You remember that Bible? It became popular in the 1960s. You can see that picture in your bulletins, but also on the screen. A picture is worth how many words? Well, you can see it has three figures. The first figure is doubled over, weighed down by sin. The second figure has dropped the load of sin at the foot of the cross. And the third figure is striding off, unburdened and free. And this Nigerian friend said, "You see that third figure? That third figure sums up everything that is wrong with you North American Christians. You think that Jesus and the cross are only about getting rid of your burdens, your troubles, your guilt. You forget that the cross and the resurrection are all about God blessing the life of obedience, even the life of suffering for Jesus' sake." What that third figure should show is, after dropping off the burden of sin, he should lift up the cross and carry it. Didn't Jesus say, "Pick up your cross and follow me"? Well, that friend was right, wasn't he? If we really believe in the resurrection, we need to be ready to live a life of radical trust in God. And that isn't easy. It isn't supposed to be. Abraham knew this. He ended up conceding the better part of the land to his nephew, Lot. And when he and Sarah were finally blessed with a baby, he was ready to sacrifice that baby when the Lord asked. As we heard here on Good Friday, Abraham stood up and said, "Here I am." Following God was, is, and always shall be a difficult and dangerous business. No wonder the Old Testament scholar Walter Brueggemann calls the resurrection both our deepest threat and our only hope. Believing in the resurrection has always called for radical trust. Radical. I know there are some folks here who do not like that word, radical. It sounds so extreme. But the word radical comes from the Latin word for root. When all is said and done, the root of our faith, the root of our hope, and the root of our love is in the resurrection. That is our new beginning. Through the resurrection of Jesus Christ, God is making all things new, including you and me. Are you ready? Not only to believe in the resurrection, but to take up your cross and follow Jesus?